before I attempt to introduce Bill Laswell, I think I'm going to ask him to do it himself, because the guy has recorded so damn many records. Where do you start? Whether it's bass playing and jazz and music and rock and roll, or whether the guy's twiddling knobs and making some kind of techno, ambient, new wave kind of sounding record, this guy has probably done it all. And he had a big hit that everyone has heard of called Rocket back in the early 80s with Herbie Hancock, which is, I think, how he's still funding all of his music. Hello, Bill Laswell.
Yes.
Hi, this is Chris Comer from Cincinnati, Ohio. It's good to talk to you.
All right.
Now, I made an assumption there in my brief introduction, which I'd really rather have you introduce yourself. I don't know where to begin. But are you still funding yourself off that Herbie Hancock record?
No, I was never doing that. In fact, you couldn't really, on the way the business was structured at that point, there was no funding ever. So it's a very small part of what's been happening over the years.
Well, you put out so many records, I'm wondering where you get the money.
Well, you get money for doing them, normally. That's the idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start off with, who is Bill Laswell, and do we want to discuss Bill Laswell, the bass player, or Bill Laswell, the producer, first?
Well, I think it's all the same, really. It's about hopefully trying to stay involved in innovative sort of activity and creating projects that sort of manifest as recorded music. So it's all related.
It is all related, but like you said, they're all different projects. Whether you're in a band called Last Exit or Massacre or Praxis or Material, or whether you're recording under your own name, Bill Laswell, or collaborating with other individuals, how does it all tie in together? And I also wanted to mention that you've got everything from really whacked out jazz music to this. What is that?
What is that? I don't know.
That's from a CD called Visitation.
Oh, okay.
That you did with Jonah Sharp.
That's right.
Yeah, what's that?
I'm not sure.
You're not going to give away trade secrets.
Well, I don't even remember that. I wouldn't have known what it was.
You wouldn't have?
I don't think so.
Why not? I mean, you recorded the damn thing.
Yeah, but, you know, it's like anything else. You move on, hopefully.
Uh-huh. I mean, is that a bass I hear, or a synthesizer, or something else you don't even know anymore?
I can't remember.
Well, what are you currently working on, and what's next?
I usually try to work on sort of several things at the same time, so you don't get stuck with the job of sort of repeating yourself with the same activity every day. So I just finished a kind of restructuring and remixing for Sony a lot of the electric music of Miles Davis from the period of 1969 till 74.
What's different about that period of Miles Davis than the older stuff he's done with his famous quartets and quintets of the 60s and the more fusion-sounding electric stuff he did in the 1980s?
Well, the earlier quintets and fixed groups were playing quite obviously ideas and compositions and sort of thematic arrangements with a group that played, you know, chordal accompaniment to those themes and then solos. And it was based on a kind of concept that you could use the word jazz to describe, in that it played a theme or a head and then played a solo and returned to a head and then went out on a solo. And it was a very fixed format. And then the fusion period of the 80s was also very formatted and very fixed in its design. But the period I chose was a time where they weren't really making compositions or song form. They were really just rolling tape, which applies very much to the same type of activity that I've been doing in the 80s and 90s. So it makes a lot of sense to go back and reinterpret a lot of those tapes as different arrangements. Different
and Miles's bands from that period, the early 70s, he was just improvising and jamming, wasn't he?
Well, it was more about, I think, the sensibility and creating a mood or a style. And a lot of people had freedom to interpret the mood or the style in any way they chose, which people could say improvising, but it's more like sort of, I don't know, improvised composition in a way, because everything has a very fixed language that it's all relating back and forth and throughout.
Now, when you say that you're going to work with those tapes and with that material, what exactly are you going to do? Are you going to take the master tapes and remix them and put your own sound effects on top of them, or
no,
what?
Not sound effects, just rearrange performances, re-EQ things, change very much the sonic picture of things pretty extremely.
And what do you hope to accomplish when it's all said and done?
something that sounds a lot better than the original interpretation.
Oh, whoa, slow down. A lot of purists are going to say, how can you do something that sounds better than Miles Davis?
Well, purists would have to check themselves because, again, it wasn't songs or compositions. It was editing that created those pieces of music during that time. It was decisions and judgments that were made by other people, not by Miles Davis, and edits that were made by someone else, not by Miles Davis.
So will the new album sound like Miles Davis, or will it sound like
Bill Laswell?
It
sound exactly like him if he was a bigger picture of what he was doing, a lot fuller, a lot more dynamics, and a lot more of everything.
And you're doing a similar project with the music of Bob Marley, aren't you?
Bob Marley project is more of a dub version of the pieces that, of Bob Marley's music, like if someone did kind of dub mixes of those pieces, which is a lot more conventional than what I did with Miles Davis.
What is dub music? Dub music is something that you've been heavily involved in. I could probably list about a dozen records you've done that would be classified as dub. But what is it?
Well, that's a word that we started using that came out of Jamaica when people would record a song for a single, for example, that would be an A-side. To release a single, you obviously need a B-side. So people to make a full A and B side, just dub, you take out the vocal or add different processing effects, reverbs and delays to the instruments and do kind of random mixing and adding and subtracting of the parts so that you have an alternate version of the A side, the pop, or the song. It's the song form. And your B side, which is an abstract version of that, became known as a dub because you were dubbing to create the B side.
I just dropped in a CD here called Mysteries of Creation, Axiom Dub. Axiom is obviously the name of your record label. But what is this CD all about? You got two CDs, you got a dozen different artists on this thing, and they're all doing something called dub.
Right. Well, that particular CD, it's just a variation of people from many different backgrounds, from different times, from different countries, and all trying to apply what we just described to sort of a situation more in the current or modern time.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the music that you've recorded, if not all of it, since your career began, most of the stuff I've been following is instrumental music. I've never known you to be in a band where there was a formal lead singer with lyrics doing pop songs, the kind of stuff that you can make $1 million off of. What's the difference between that kind of music and the kind of music that you're doing, besides the obvious fact that there's no lead singer?
Well, I mean, I've worked with a lot of singers. It's just in constructing live situations where it's, in a lot of situations, it's very improvised. For the live approach, there's not always a person that does singing that can apply to that particular kind of a situation. It's a little more difficult, so it lends itself more to instrumental music, or the sound in general.
Are there any singers you've ever wanted to work with or have worked with that you enjoyed? And I, as a side note, I know that you were one of the people who helped discover Whitney Houston.
Well, that was a long time ago, but I mean, this kind of singing is always interesting to me, and it's valuable, and it's part of a tradition that, you know, rhythm and blues and blues singers have always been interesting to me. It's just lately I haven't worked with so many, but I'm open to doing that, and from time to time I do work with singers.
Yeah, that record you did with James Blood Ulmer and Ronald Shannon Jackson is a highlight of my record collection. I can listen to that record over and over again because the rhythm section is so groovy and flowing, and it just works with Blood Ulmer's lead vocals.
Right. Well, there's a new one coming out with Blood also doing some singing with the drummer called Ziggy Modalese from the Meters.
Mm-hmm.
And Bernie Worrell and Amina Myers, and that's called Third Rail, and it's going to come out on Antilles, on Verve, probably in March.
So Blood is still out there and working, huh?
Yeah, definitely.
Good. Where do you want to take it from now? Can we talk about some of your older groups?
Whatever you need to do.
Okay, take a listen to this. I'm sure you will have recognized this, and tell me a little bit about this next record that I'm going to play for you. We're playing a little Drop the Needle here. Now, to the casual listener, they're going to say, what in the hell is going on there? You got a guitar playing in one rhythm, the bass, who knows what he's doing, and that drummer, he's playing a rhythm totally different than the guitar player and the bass player.
Right.
That's Massacre, as you know, Fred Frith on guitar, Bill Maher on drums. Am I pronouncing his name correctly?
Fred Maher.
Fred Maher and yourself, Bill Laswell, on bass. This is one of the first records I ever picked up that you played on. How did this thing get started, and whatever happened to your work with Fred Frith?
I think that was early, maybe 80, 81, I can't remember. Mm-hmm. And part of that was recorded in Paris, I think.
Really?
Part of it's from a live concert. But I met Fred Frith when he first came to New York, and we helped put together some groups to create festivals and sort of showcases or outlets for him and some other musicians that were coming over from England and from Europe. And I stayed in touch with him over the years. Around that time, we created this trio with Fred Ma, which I think lasted for a year or two.
Yeah, and you guys, like we were talking about, it sounds like for the most part you were just jamming and improvising and having a pretty good time. Was it fun?
Yeah, but it started out with pieces that were structured, that were written by or created by Fred, and then later on we started to improvise using that same language and found that the improvised pieces that we did later on sounded almost as structured as the written pieces. So it became, we were able to improvise structure, which I think kind of relates to what I was saying about the Miles Davis work.
Do you think enough improvising musicians, whether they're jazz or rock or anything else, improvise enough structure? Or do you think when guys improvise, they just twiddle around like the Grateful Dead too much?
Well, there's a lot of people that just play nothing, and they call it improvising. And I always preferred to hear people play that had other aspects of their playing beyond just making noise. And it's, you know, I like noise as much as anyone, but certain times you'd like to get a bit more out of a statement than just the noise of it.
Right on. I'm going to play another piece from another band of yours that I think improvises structure just about as good as any group I've ever heard, and that would be Last Exit. Now, you guys did one studio record. Last Exit was Ronald Shannon Jackson playing the drums, Peter Brotzman playing the saxophone, yourself on bass, and Sonny Sharrock on guitar. Now, is it Sharrock or Sharrock?
Sharrock.
Sonny Sharrock is playing guitar. In this group, you guys did 3 or 4 live albums, and then the studio record. I want to talk about the studio record you did.
Right.
How did you put that together? I know there's a story behind it.
Mostly just improvising a lot in the studio and then putting it together with tape and some sort of quick overdub.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you guys go in like one at a time or something?
I can't remember. I think the drums and bass, we did a lot of that, and then we added the things after that.
Yeah, now I know that you like to move on from project to project pretty quick, but I gotta ask you, why didn't you record more music in the studio with Last Exit? Iron Path.
I would have liked to. I didn't think we had the outlets to release anything, and we didn't always have the time to do it properly. It was very much a live band.
I think Iron Path may be one of the best records ever recorded in any indie idiom and any kind of music you want to talk about. Do you concur with me? And as far as your catalog goes, how does Iron Path stack up with some of the other records you've produced?
Well, I was really, you know, I was happy with it. I thought it was a definite breakthrough at the time, and I don't recall getting too much support on that. So
why not? It was so heavy.
Just to the next thing.
I mean, this thing makes Black Sabbath look like a bunch of hippies, you know? This
right.
is a very heavy record. See what I mean?
Right.
Don't tell me you couldn't get any support for this. I know Europe was crazy for Last Exit, but how come you couldn't get any support in America?
Well, you still can't really get too much support in America, except for, you know, pockets of interest in places that are all very far from each other. It's very hard to work in America doing this kind of activity without people becoming very bitter very quickly.
What do you mean by bitter? Jaded?
Not so much jaded in that they don't feel like they're being treated properly or respected or even accepted in some cases. And there's a lot of great musicians who, and it's an old story, end up spending most of their time working in Europe and then second Japan.
Or working at a fried chicken place.
Well, that's probably the safest way to go.
We're talking to Bill Laswell, and over the years you've put out how many records? Maybe 100, 200? I don't know.
No, it's quite a bit more than that, I think, at this point.
Yeah, scadillions of them. You've produced, composed, improvised, and played bass on, oh God, I don't know where to start. I asked you before where you get the money. Where do you get the inspiration for all this different music?
Well, I think it's important to keep investigating new things and not to forget. Can you hold on 1 second? I got to get rid of this.
Somebody's
calling.
Well, in typical fashion, we're being put on hold by our guest, Bill Laswell. I'm your host, Chris Comer. I'll be here with you a little while longer, or at least as long as I can keep Bill on the phone.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm right here.
Okay, sir.
Who was that?
Ronnie
James Dio?
Hopefully not. It's a secret.
It's a big secret. You're always working on something.
Yeah.
What were we talking about? Your inspirations. Maybe I can do a quick little edit here. Besides some of the things we already talked about, the old Miles Davis groups, what are the big influences on how you turned out today, musically?
Well, there's so many, you know, and they should be still happening every day. So it's very hard to make a list of those people and events without leaving out probably about most of it. But it's so many, and if you just grab a handful of things, you can always associate with certain times. I mean, I think at a certain age, when people are growing up, certain things affect them at that age more than other times in their life. So I was able to see sort of Jimi Hendrix and Miles Davis and people like this and improvising rock bands like Cream, and then later on improvising sort of funk groups like Funkadelic and a lot of more experimental music, and then gradually into music that came from other cultures over time, which is all, which I got to understand by relating it to things I heard here from Pharoah Sanders or John Coltrane. I would discover Indian music and African music, and then music in Central Asia, and it just keeps kind of unfolding, and it's endless, really.
And you work it all into almost every project you work on. You call them all projects, and I'll tell you, I don't know anybody that has been in as many bands as you and been the leader of all of them.
Well, I wasn't really the leader in most of those live things. I get associated as being that because of being around sometimes for a while, but in a lot of the cases I would much rather not be, and there's a lot of people that are better suited to do that than I would be.
Well, you're definitely the leader of a project you call Material, which started out with Fred Maher, the guy from Massacre, and another guy named Michael Beinhorn.
Mm-hmm.
Am I saying his name right?
Yeah.
And then I don't know who all is in the group now, except for you got Nicky Skopelidis. Am I saying his name right?
Skopelidis.
Is he Greek?
Yes.
Is he New York Greek or is he Greek?
New York Greek, Greek.
Yeah, okay. All you guys from New York are from somewhere else. I seem to think I read somewhere that you're from Michigan.
I was born in Illinois, and I came here from Michigan.
Anyway, Material. What's Material, and why do you have so many different people work through it?
Well, right now it's kind of a production company, and I just use the name to create records or concerts or events, and whenever we can put together the right people to do the right kind of work, then we call it that, and we, you know, try to make events or recordings.
Why so many different names? Why haven't you gone the route of somebody like Robert Fripp and call all your bands the same thing, King Crimson?
Well, King Crimson sounds like King Crimson, and mm-hmm. All of my different things don't.
No, but there's always definite carryovers, like some of the stuff on Sacrificed by the album Praxis.
Right.
The band Praxis, the album Sacrificed. Some of that stuff sounds a little bit like Material, you know?
Could be, yeah, but not always directly. And there's a lot of developments in Praxis. The last group we had 5 turntable players, and that's probably very different than the Material.
5 group. Turntables? That's bigger than most rap groups will have.
No, it's battle DJs and with guitar, bass, and drums.
Now, is that the thing you did, and I'm looking for it here, called the turntable record? I got all my CDs here, and when you want to find one, you can't. Altered Beats, is that the Altered Beats group you're referring to?
Altered Beats was more of a compilation of a lot of different people, and this Praxis idea was live, so far only live, and there's a record coming out, I think, next month on a label run by Alan Douglas, who was the producer of Jimi Hendrix, who's made a new label, and he's putting that out next, I think, in March.
A Praxis turntable record.
Well, Praxis live with DJs.
Now, what do you think of the turntable as a musical instrument? A lot of people think that sounds silly, or they don't even know that LPs still exist because everybody's got compact discs now. But how does the turntable relate to a live working rock and roll band?
Well, it works as an instrument. A turntable is an instrument that can be any instrument. All you have to do is choose a sound and play it.
And you scoot the record back and forth.
You can do that. There's all kinds of techniques that have developed since the early 80s.
Could you describe a couple to the uninitiated?
Well, let's say you have to check for more of the individuals that are doing that. And in Brooklyn, there's a group called the X-Men, which is different configurations of DJs that play in a kind of competitive battle style, but are also very much individual artists. In San Francisco, there's a group called Invisible Scratch Pickles, which is with a DJ called Q-Bert, and Mixmaster Mike and Shortcut and people like that who are very much creating their own style. There's another one called Beat Junkies. There's a DJ in Florida called Craze, and there's still the roots of the whole thing, which started in the South Bronx with a guy called Grand Wizard Theodore, which then gave way to DST and Grandmaster Flash and all these people. And it's all about a 20-year evolution of this idea of the turntable being manipulated as a sound source, as a first a percussive instrument, but now I see that it's not limited to percussion, that you can think of it from anything from a drum to an orchestra.
Could you think of it as like the band behind the rapper, instead of having a rap person sitting in front reading some poetry? Is the music that's behind that.
The band behind the rapper, but you could think of it as the band behind the concert violinist as well.
Mm-hmm. Have there been a lot of rap records made with concert violins?
Probably not enough, but
maybe it's time to start, and you just might be the man to record one.
It's open.
We're talking to Bill Laswell. My name is Chris Comer, and I'm your host. Is there anything you want to know about Cincinnati, Ohio, Bill? Because I'm right here, and I've got my finger on the pulse of it.
Cincinnati, Ohio?
Yeah, you know, in Cincinnati, we arrest old ladies for feeding parking meters. We give jaywalking tickets to blind guys walking across the street who get hit by buses. And most recently, we got a group of Christians and Jewish people who want to censor local talk shows, myself included. What do you think of all that?
Well, you should probably kill them.
You ought to come out and visit sometime.
Well, I know I've been there. Bootsy Collins lives there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's already should make Cincinnati a great place.
Well, I remember driving down the street near the university one afternoon, and there's a guy walking down the street, a short black guy, and he's got this really cool jacket on. And on the back of the jacket is the Axiom record label
logo.
The logo, it's got the little cross, and it says Axiom across.
Right.
And I stopped my car, and I got out, and I said, "Who are you, and where did you get that cool jacket? I've got every release on the Axiom label that came out, because it's all great music." And a guy goes, "Oh, my dad is Bootsy Collins."
Okay.
I'm like, "No way. Nobody's dad is Bootsy freaking Collins. That would be like my dad being Jimi Hendrix."
Right.
My dad is a guy who works in advertising. You know, I thought that was pretty cool.
Right.
So there you have it. I'll tell you, I've been doing talk radio here in Cincinnati for 5 or 6 years now and have yet to been able to book Bootsy Collins to come onto the show. So if you see him, tell him that we said, "Hey, come on down."
Well, I'll try.
Will you? Want to go to next from this? We've been talking about almost every. Hey, we have not discussed Arcana yet. Tell us a little bit about Arcana.
Well, that was a name that started originally. I think John Zorn was going to use it for the name of a record company, and when he did the search on it, he found that there was already a corporation called that. And I liked the name, so I asked him if I could use it for a project with Derek Bailey and Tony Williams.
Now listen to this. This is Derek Bailey. That guy's crazy. What's he playing there?
That sounds like a guitar.
Well, yeah, but I mean, he's not playing, he's not strumming chords.
No, he's playing Derek Bailey.
Yeah, where's he coming from? Who is Derek Bailey? I don't know much about that individual.
Derek Bailey came out of England and was one of the first or original real improvisers to start a particular language or a certain approach to his instrument and stay consistent with it and develop it over the years and encourage activity with other people that were sort of like-minded and that they were exploring ways of freeing themselves from routines or ways of looking at instruments as systems and more like just as a freer way to express something with an instrument. So he was very important and still is for just the whole possibility of what you can do with instruments.
His guitar playing vaguely reminds me of Fred Frith. I don't know if you feel that that's accurate or not.
Fred would probably admit to being, you know, early on when he was younger, really influenced by Derek Bailey.
So Derek really goes far back.
Oh, yeah.
How come we haven't heard of him until recently? How come I haven't heard of him until recently? And don't tell me that I'm ignorant, because I'm not.
Well, you know, it's something you have to look for. And mm-hmm. In certain cases, it might be hard to find recordings by certain people in certain areas. I know probably in New York or in San Francisco or bigger cities, maybe it's easier, I know it was easier at one time to find all kinds of more bizarre recordings, and certain areas may not have that as accessible. But he is quite known internationally, and there is an audience for him and a lot of respect for his work.
And the group is called Arcana. You released a record on the DIW record label with Tony Williams playing drums and yourself playing bass.
Right.
How did you guys get together, and how is this going to be expanded for your next record?
Well, it's only related in the name for the next release, and that Tony Williams is the drummer, and all the rest of the construct. It took a long time to make the next record, and it was done over a long period of time of constructing and reconstructing sort of fixed musical ideas that involved other artists improvising on top of that, and then in some cases embellishing themes and melodies. But it was quite a long process, which is not quite finished yet. There's still one more piece to do.
And who all's going to be playing on the new version of Arcana?
So far, Graham Haynes, who's a great cornet player.
Mm-hmm.
If anyone interested in Miles Davis or Olu Dara's playing would be interested in him. Pharoah Sanders, who's a saxophonist. Tony Williams, Buckethead, Bayard Lancaster, Nikki Skopelidis, and the last track is with Ornette Coleman.
Have you recorded with Ornette yet?
No, we talked about it, and that's the last piece I have to do.
Is it going to be harmelotic?
Well, I would certainly imagine that it would be.
What is harmelotics, and do you subscribe to that idea of music?
Absolutely. But harmelotic, I think, to me, probably has a different meaning because I'm not a student and I'm not an authority.
Hey, hold on a minute. Hear that bass line? I'd have to go dig through the CDs, but I could swear I've heard that bass line on one of your dub records.
It's quite possible.
So do you feel like sometimes you start revolving the same bass lines around and around, and do you ever think you overdo it? Pardon me?
But I do it all the time. It's not intentional.
It's not. Do you ever feel like sometimes you get stuck in a groove or you start playing the same thing and you got to break yourself of the habit?
Now, that would be being in a band and being on a record label, I think.
You don't ever want to be in a band or be on a record label or play with Michael Stipe.
That would sort of be what you just described.
Yeah. But how come? Do you feel like that's selling out or you know, selling your soul to the devil or something?
No, that would probably be a lot more interesting.
You think? Have you sold your soul to the devil?
Not that I know of. I'm trying to buy in at the moment.
Okay. What is Deadline, anyway?
Deadline was a project that went back, I guess it was 83, around this time, 83, 84. Was put together by a drummer named Philip Wilson. And then we did one project and he invited a lot of guests, and then later on we used the name again in the early 90s. It was the Philip Wilson's project.
Yeah, and the record you put out in the early 90s is on Day 8 Records called Dissident.
That was not really my project, more Jonas Hellborg is the bass player.
You work with him a lot, don't you?
I have in the past, not recently.
Do you like the way he plays?
Well, it's a very unique, you know, approach to the instrument, and he has a lot of technique, and I think he's expanding it all the time. Right.
Webb is one of the most avant-garde things I've ever heard you put out, and by the term avant-garde, I don't want to get all these stupid music terms all mixed up. But to me, this is the record I play out in the front porch on Halloween night.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Right.
This one and the second disc of the Painkiller Execution Ground.
Right.
These two discs are just spooky.
Right.
What's Webb all about? You did it with a guy whose name I cannot pronounce.
Well, Webb is really the product of Terry Samlett, who's an artist who's dealing with mostly with computer and electronic music and very advanced, I think, in that area and trying all kinds of extreme things, and he has very much his own signature.
And what was your input on this particular record?
Well, a lot less than his. I would say that's more to do with his sensibility. And
mm-hmm.
My input is more like just adding sounds and tones and then balancing things and processing things in a different way.
Are you the guy that was twiddling all the knobs on this one?
Well, not always just that, but just finding sound sources that try to, maybe that might relate to others, and then trying to, you know, blend them together.
Do you find that musical language is limiting to the musical expression when you actually play music?
Well, as much as any language is to any.
Because I sit here and I'm talking about your records and I can't find any better words than, well, this is avant-garde or this is really out there.
Well, you have to use those words sometimes to speed up the explanation of something. Journalists need those, and we need them sometimes just to save time.
What are some better words to use that would describe, say, this web, which is what I'm playing right now, or some of the other records you've put out recently?
Well, there are no words that would make it fair to someone who's not completely versed in this kind of area of this world. So you say, you have to use these kind of descriptions if you're speaking to people that you want to bring into this area. You can't just overlook the fact that not everybody's versed in this language. So sound is really what we're always talking about, and music, but there's so many different aspects of it, and you can't just say, I'm interested in sound and music, and expect someone to go the full spectrum, because everyone's kind of nailed down in terms of taste in these different sort of areas that they've been limited to having to deal with. Oh, and that's based on being stuck in time, because there's not enough time to sort of go out and experience all of it. No one has that kind of available time, unless you're someone who does this all the time.
Speaking of time, you're putting out a CD about one every 2 months. Do you have, how much time does it take? I mean, do you work on this 5 days a week, 7 days a week, all night long, or do you ever get some time off?
It depends. Sometimes for, over a period of time, there's quite a focused, consistent flow of putting out things, and other times it's important to travel and to, make contact with people and play live and do different kinds of activities. So there are moments where there's an overflow of recorded music being released as CDs.
Do you ever think that maybe you put out too many CDs?
Well, I've definitely put out too many CDs, but that's not my problem.
It's not?
No.
Well, whose problem is that? The guys who are buying them like me?
The person that bought every one of them and disagreed with about half of them.
Well, whether somebody disagrees with them or not, the fact that they're buying them must be some element of success for you. I know that they're available at more mainstream record stores and CD stores than they were when I was in college back in the 1980s.
Well, I think things are getting better in that sense, that people are distributing more interesting or more radical or more experimental things into other areas, and that can only be good, I think, for people that are maybe tired of certain things and interested in something else. So everything leads to something else, so they're all just steps.
You think there's more music available now than there was in the 80s and the 70s before that and the 60s before that?
Yeah, I'm positive there is.
Is that because of the CD revolution?
I think it's just, again, time that things, that it adds up. And people are being encouraged more now to work maybe outside of the control system that exists as a corporation, that they could make their own music in their own home and release it and manufacture it and print it and press it and distribute it themselves, which is highly recommended. And if they can do that and create a successful income and business out of it, then that's really good for pushing what's important, which is ultimately creativity and trying to always evolve and do good work. That's what's important, not the money or the fame or any of that.
When the notes on a CD read, conceived and constructed by Bill Laswell, as opposed to composed and arranged by or performed by, what does that mean?
It's just all different excuses or ways out of getting tired of saying produced by or created by, or there's a million different ways to say it, and maybe in the future it won't say anything.
Is that kind of like saying a Spike Lee joint? It's just better than saying produced by Spike Lee?
The same thing.
Yeah. Okay. What kind of movies do you like, Bill Laswell?
Haven't been watching any movies lately. I always get really distracted.
How come you haven't done movie soundtracks? It seems to me the kind of music that you do, being that it's sometimes moody, ambient, even spooky, that it would be conducive to the movie soundtrack business.
It's totally conducive to the movie soundtrack in terms of image and sound, and perfectly all that makes sense, but it's the business that's crazy, because in trying to do soundtracks, you definitely find yourself in the middle of a lot more people and opinions and points of view than you find making a record. So you're unfortunately dealing with a very high quotient of idiots for the most part. it makes it very difficult.
I'm sure that the money would be good, though, but I don't think that you're in it for the money.
No, I've done a few lately, actually, small films, and they'll all be coming out this year, and I'm with Island Records, and Chris Blackwell, he had recommended some things recently, which will come out through Island Pictures. And I'm starting to get into it. I just want to do it right, and I want to do it if it makes sense. It's really easy to be a sort of failed composer or a lost musician and find yourself comfortably in LA with all these soundtracks to do, and at the end of it there's no music and there's no point. It's just business. And if I was interested in the business, I would have taken a left or a right way back, you know. So I'm trying to hold on to what I'm trying to manifest.
This afternoon we've been mostly talking about various Bill Laswell projects and bands and music that was conceived and constructed by yourself, Bill Laswell. But what about the work you've done as a producer for different groups, Herbie Hancock, which we discussed earlier, and PIL, Johnny Rotten and Johnny Lydon, and other individuals who have hired you to come in and produce their record? Are you in demand as a studio producer?
No, I don't. Probably not. I would say among people that are interested in the work and, you know, the type of areas I'm working in, there's probably a mutual respect with a lot of people that are evolving, like Ja Wobble and Paul Schutz and Scorn and people like that who are developing studio work, and I'm very interested in that. But as far as labels, which it's all a monopoly of who's hot this week and who's easy to deal with, I'm probably not even considered, which is definitely a pleasure.
All right. Well, it seems to me that you'd be much more in demand, especially with some of the work you did with Herbie Hancock, which probably made Herbie a few bucks.
Oh, absolutely. But that was also a long time ago. And I put a lot of time into doing very sort of radical improv things and a lot of time into traveling and making records in Africa and Asia. And, you know, that doesn't apply to any sort of pop chart. I think people don't really make that connection. It's not about music. In that sense, it's very much about something else.
Do you want to catch your other line? It might be David Lynch looking for a soundtrack.
Hold on one second. You could be right. Hello?
Hello, I'm right here.
Yeah.
Was that David Lynch?
No, that was totally irrelevant. You don't want to know.
Wasn't? Okay. It seems to me like you got a few secrets. You're not telling me who's calling you on the other line, and you won't give away some of your studio secrets. You got a lot going on over there?
You know, just the normal everyday activity.
You own your own studio? It's called Greenpoint Studio. Am I correct or am I incorrect?
No, I have a studio. I don't own the structure or the building, but I've been able to acquire all it sort of takes to make records.
And what do you need besides your typical, you know, you need probably some kind of digital recording deck and a mixing board and your bass guitar, but what else do you need in that studio?
No, we have a very old school sort of state-of-the-art old-school studio with Neve consoles and Studer machine and a lot of old outboard gear, and there is a computer and digital formats on smaller machines, but it's really done very, very old-fashioned.
You use analog equipment?
Yeah.
Most of the time. Do you have a Korg Poly 6 synthesizer?
Maybe. I'm not sure what's here now, but maybe.
I think I've heard that one on some of the Divination records. I also think I've heard Happy Apples on one of them. You know what a happy apple is?
Oh, yeah, I know what you mean. I do have one of those. I don't know where it came from.
I think you used it on one of your Divination records.
Divination, the first track on the Ambient.
Yeah, I just wanted to point, because a friend of mine's got a kid. He's got a happy apple, and at a gig I was playing at, we took a couple of them along and started, you know, at the quiet part going.
Well, you nailed that one. I'm busted. So.
All right. Thank you for taking my call today. Bill Laswell, thank you very much.
All right.